Welcome to Ever Beyond, 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 on Wolf Spirit Radio, Ever Beyond Radio, and Tir na Sao in Ireland. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, beyond. Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. Good afternoon, good morning, and good evening, wherever you might be on this rotating globe. Yes, it's a globe. It's never been flat. We are here today with another man who's been fighting for the truth about, you know, the nature of our reality from space. Brett Colin Shepherd, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. Right, let me just fade you up a bit. You're a bit quiet there. So, yeah, good afternoon. And where are you speaking from? You're from, where are you speaking from?
I am speaking from a little town called Belen, New Mexico.
Berlin. All right. Oh, there you go.
B-E-L-E-N. Berlin.
Oh, yeah. Berlin. All right, not Berlin.
No.
Really? There's a new... I thought that was in Neuschwabenland, anyway. New Berlin. Yeah. Anyway, so here we are. Brett's been on the show before, so we won't do too much of a kind of intro, but do you want to kind of give a very quick sketch of where you're coming from and your group, the Lars, and take it from there, really?
Absolutely. My name is Brett Colin Shepherd. I founded the Lunar Anomaly Research Society, which was formerly the Moon Anomaly Research Society, but its acronym, of course, spells Mars, and, you know, so I had to change it. The Lunar Anomaly Research Society basically is an image analyst group that analyzes images of the moon, and mostly. Although we have a lot of Mars imagery in there and also some other space imagery, whatever's interesting. I've been doing this for quite some time, and my interest started when I was 15 years old, when a lady from Stanford Research Institute showed me a bunch of pictures, hours of pictures in my art class at the end of the day, that were of lunar anomalies on the moon. Of course, I didn't know that that's what they were at the time, because she said that there were that the images was from various artists. And as far as I know, I am the only person on Earth that has ever done those images in the future. So 40 years or 30 years later, I founded the Lunar Anomaly Research Society and was looking closely at the images. And what did I find? I find the same exact imagery that I saw when I was 15 years old.
Dum, dum, dum.
Yes.
So that was actually the result. That was a plot line of a Doctor Who show recently.
Oh, my gosh.
About,
really?
It was about Shakespeare, but basically he actually asked the question. Because he says, you know, he finds this, you know, down and out, and he sort of gives him the whole bunch of stories and says, here, publish these, and, you know, because he gives him the book of, you know, the complete works of Shakespeare. Here you go, mate, publish these.
Yes.
And so what happens is, who wrote the book?
Right.
You see? So you're there stuck in this little paradox. What does it feel like?
Yes, it's the mystery of my life, really. A lot of other things have surrounded that have pushed me in this direction. I've tried everything else. I've tried nursing. I went to the army. Everything I did seemed to not be right with me. You know, they were failures, and one right after the other. And until I started doing this again, Nothing seemed right. So it felt as though maybe the universe or some men in black or something were pushing me in this direction. Which is very interesting because not too long ago, about a year and a half ago, I met Ken Johnston. And through some research, image analysis and research that I was doing on lunar bases and so forth, and I ran across his video, you know, where he was describing lunar bases that he saw in some 70 or 16 millimeter type film from Apollo 14. And at the time, he said it was Apollo 11 because he didn't really want to give away what, you know, what mission it was exactly. When I got to know him, he really wanted to get the truth out about his life. And when I met him, I found that he was basically the ending of a book that I was writing called Digital Moon, which is not out yet. I'm still writing it. But he actually worked for NASA for about 14 years or so, quite a while. He worked for them for the duration of the Apollo program. And some of his jobs were to be an astronaut consultant, a civilian astronaut consultant pilot, working for Grumman Aerospace at the time. And he tested the lunar module and actually trained the astronauts to go into space. One of his later jobs, after he was laid off and he went back to NASA, was the director of the data and photo department at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. And from there, he started collecting the images that is now his archive. He was directed to throw away some images, and he was, again, kind of canned, you know, laid off or whatever, because he refused to follow orders to destroy lunar images. Now, these lunar images are very important and crucial in his story, because he was asked by a Dr. Page to do a private showing of an Apollo 14 film, an exact can of film that he was directed to get out of the top secret clearance section of the data department. And so he took this and he set it up for Dr. Page and his the rest of his scientists, friends and whatnot. And this was at the NASA mansion that's now, you know, on the grounds of Johnson Space Center. Now, while he was showing this film, he was coming up to a crater named Tsiolkovsky, which is, you know, a very famous large crater on the backside of the moon. Half of the crater was lit because of the way the sun was, and there apparently were lunar domes of clear crystalline structure with lights inside of them and smokestacks. And this is more or less the description that he gave. And Dr. Page looked at that and looked at the rest of the guys and said, "What do you think about that, boys?" And they kind of chuckled because they seemed to have known that they were there anyway. Now, Dr. Johnston took the film back and put it back in the can and took it back to the data receiving laboratory and checked it in. The next day, the same day actually, he noticed that there were some people in that secret clearance department that were painting out negatives. And they were very large negatives that were up on a transparency and whatnot, and also small ones. And they were literally painting out the lunar backgrounds. And he asked what they were doing that for. And they said that that they were painting out the stars or anything that might confuse people. Now, Yes. And then the next day, he checked out this film because he wanted to give a presentation basically in the lunchroom, you know, with his brother, A.R. Johnston, who was also a scientist working there at NASA. And he was showing the film, and they came up to, he checked out the exact same film, you know, and they were coming up to Tsiolkovsky crater, and there was nothing there. It was painted out black, which means that they would have had to have painted it out, spliced it together, and literally copied the entire roll of film overnight.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, you know, but luckily, Ken Johnston Sr. had enough foresight, Dr. Johnston, you know, had enough foresight to save these records for us for the future. He basically took a set home, and I guess he had a couple of sets. He had one set that he gave to his alma mater in Oklahoma, and I guess the building burned down, and that was that for that set. But he still has this one set, and it's fairly it's not really a complete entire archive of Apollo imagery, but what he has is very special because it's first generation images. Now, when I started looking at these images as an anomalist, I started noticing things right away, especially in the Finley Holiday film slides, which are, you know, they were basically slides that were made for the heads of NASA departments and so forth to show them what progress they were making on the moon and what they'd found. And in one of these slides, there is very clear aligned array of buildings or satellite dishes or something to that nature. I have a very clear picture of that. And this was on the lunar surface in the background of the Apollo 15 command module. I also found in the lunar sky of Apollo 11 an object that is very clearly made by some entities, or, you know, it's not a rock, or it's not something natural. It's floating around, and it has literally a large appendage or antenna sticking off of it, and it looks almost like some type of satellite. But this was in the 1960s. So I asked Ken, could that be the command module floating around in the sky? And he said, no, there's no way, you know, that could be the command module, because it was in a different location at the time of their landing and so forth. So he said, that is definitely not ours. And I looked at another image on the Earthrise in Apollo 12, and there was actually something skitching across, literally flying, you know, over the surface, pretty high up, over the surface of the moon in this Earthrise image. And I looked up
a normal Saturday afternoon on an air, you know, by an airfield, you just see something going in the background, you know. Just, yeah, it was just normal, you know.
What it looked like, except for I've never seen that type of craft. It's not ours, you know.
Not one of ours, yeah. And so here's the thing, Brett. We know all about the secret space program, right? We know that NASA's essentially a front organization.
It's a secret space program.
Yeah, so really, what's the story that is really going on? Who's been up there? Who's up there? And who doesn't want... Who isn't allowed back there? Can you fill in those little blanks there?
Yes, that's a very interesting thing. Ken Johnston, was very much a part of that history, and he'd heard a lot of things that we were not privy to hear, you know. So during the Apollo 17 trans-Earth insertion, which they were coming back from the moon to the Earth, they caught a signal that was coming from the moon that was not our signal. And briefly, you know, it said that they don't want us back and that we're not ready yet.
And do we know who sent that message? And in what form was it? Like, in data? In, you know,
very much in, very much in English. It was you know, it was one of the transmissions that that they caught that are not public. You know,
and audio English. Get the crap out. No trace of a German accent was there by any chance?
No, but you would think so. you know, given the Iron Sky.
Iron Sky, yeah, that's right.
I love that movie. And there may be some truth to that, you know, since they're, you know, the descendants of Aldebaran and all that jazz.
That's
know?
Right. Can we talk about Aldebaran? Because it's come up in conversation and in a couple of shows that Aldebaran appears to be... I'm sure we may have covered it a little bit in the last show, but I'm really interested to mine what information you've got about Aldebaran, Sumeria, what was Sumeria before the Aldebarans, and any kind of story that you might have pertaining and appertaining to that situation, sir.
Well, yes, as you know, Nazi Germany, or you know what, I'm not even going to call it Nazi Germany. I'm going to call it the Holy Roman Reich. Because that's what it was. It was a Christian Reich.
Yeah.
And they were obsessed with their human origins, and the real society was developed, which was some psychics like Maria Orsic and the rest, and some Knights Templars and so forth. And they were basically a think tank about human origins. And you know, there were some other people involved, the Thule Society, with Madame Blavatsky, and you know, some of the occultists got involved with that. And what's interesting is Maria Orsic, she did some automatic writing, and this writing was not, by the way, Sumerian. It was Illyrian. It was ancient Dacian.
It was what?
It was Illyrian writing. It's the oldest writing on Earth. It's older than Sumeria.
Illyrian writing?
Yes.
Which comes from where?
Is
found where, let's say?
It would be found in Illyria. The Illyrian people, not far from Greece, you know, and, you know, around that area, you know, in the Mediterranean.
All right, so it's one of those Greek regions that has its like Lydia and Mixolydian had all these little places had their own modes of music. So
yes,
this would have its own philosophy.
Yeah, I can briefly describe the migration there. There were the ancient Dacians and Thracians, which were part of the Pelasgian Empire. Thracia was actually Troy. It was the city of Troy. And Dacia were the ancient Greeks. And they had migrated down and they had conquered Troy. They were all the same people, but, you know, they had basically divided themselves into city-states and whatnot for control purposes and all that, and tribal reasons. Tribal meaning just family, you know. So they had come down from the mouth of the Danube River, where most of you know, most of that area at the time was what we think of as Atlantis, way back then before the flood. Now we're talking about BC, prehistoric times, and this area, there was no such thing as primitive man or something like that. These people were very advanced, you know. They were created, so to speak, or repopulated by basically space aliens. One in particular named Pelage, who was one of the in their folklore was a man in a cave that was very advanced, and he had created them out of clay, similar to the Sumerian story, created them from clay pots and so forth from the earth. So he created a race of mortal men, and that's how their story kind of goes. They consider Pallage and the other entities as gods on their king's list, and each king would claim to be the descendant of Pallage or the descendant of Poseidon and so on and so forth, the descendant of Apollo. So these people had migrated. There was, at the time, a terrible flood that happened, or it may have happened over time. The Black Sea was a lake, a very large lake at the time, but was considered to them an ocean. You know, so the Pillars of Hercules would be the area of Thracia and Istanbul, the strait that goes in between there. And that is what Herodotus would describe as the Pillars of Hercules. And beyond that was the allegory for the city of Atlantis, which was the Dacian, ancient Pelasgian Empire. Now, the Greeks and the Romans are the descendants of Thracia and Dacia. There's no doubt about that. The Pope wanted to cover all of that up because they seem to, for control purposes, want to hide their history or their ancient history to divide their city-states and whatnot. This has always been the problem with them, and it's the reason why we can't learn about our true history, is they actually hide it. But luckily there are Gnostics and other people that were very decent human beings, and they would hide their information in caves, and they would take it word of mouth into their secret societies. And that was the purpose of the secret societies at the time, was to basically write down for the future, because they were very aware of time, and they were very aware that this would be important in the future. So they wrote that down, and they passed it along to Knights Templars and Scottish Rite Masons and on down into America and all that. We are the descendants of, literally, of space aliens. There's no doubt about that. Much of the folklore that even was taken from the Black Sea area to Sumeria, which the people, you know, that were depicted as having blonde hair, blue eyes, and all that, you know, because they were from the Black Sea area. Now, these Ari, or Aryan people, not Nazis, not to be confused with Nazis, but ancient people of that area, they were very tribal, you know, and they migrated out all through Europe and through Denmark and Ireland and Scotland and the UK, all of that. This is where they originally came from. They were the Hyperboreans. Now, what does this have to do with the moon? Well, I was looking at these images, and one image in particular, which is 1197_med from Lunar Orbiter 1, has literally embedded in it the entire Pelasgian Empire's king's list. Now, what I mean by king's list is the Greek mythology was actually real kings of the Pelasgian Empire. For instance, Hercules was the first, was the founder of Troy, or the Thracians, and so on and so forth. There was literally Apollo, and there was Theseus and Poseidon. All of these people were actually real people that ruled a kingdom, and some of them were probably from migrations from space. But their technology, of course, you know, because of our electromagnetics and mostly our frequency, does not work today. So it probably didn't work back then all that well. They did have some technology. They had holographic technology and whatnot that is still today in the mountains of the Bashigi Mountains, and inside these hollow caverns and so forth. It's a very interesting story about where we come from, and to follow this through modern day images is very fascinating. There are literally ruins on the moon. I have pictures of them, and they are not exactly, you know, the typical moon image. This is an image of a landscape of the moon from Apollo 12, and you can literally see squared out shapes of blocks and everything else, and actually lines that form pentagonal type shapes. There are what seems to be an effigy on the moon. So these first generation images frankly show a lot more than anything that's been shown online. And we are working with Ken to actually publish his archive in PDF format at least. And we also helped him with his autobiography, which can be found at Ken's Moon, KenJohnstonMedia.com. So if anyone wants to go there, they can look up a lot of information about Dr. Johnston. And that will be the resting place of at least the PDF of his archive. And I've already got the mission reports out and all of that. Some pictures that I'm talking about are in those mission reports.
Right. One of the things I was just... Big echoes. One of the things I've been thinking about just while you've been talking is, sure. Would it be possible to publish a zip file of all the photographs, you know, as big, good a resolution as you can get,
yes,
onto the torrent network, which means it'll never go away. Once it's in the torrent network, you can't get rid of it.
Ah, really? Okay.
That might be a possible repository. Check it out. It's called the BitTorrent Network, and it's how people download movies and things.
Yes, I totally agree with that, and that will probably happen later. But Ken is not a rich man, you know, and he is still a red-blooded American capitalist, you know, from back in the 70s and so forth. So he would like to at least make a little bit of money off of them, and to have people enjoy them. He's going to offer a very inexpensive version in PDF, and also a book version, you know. And after all that, I am sure they will go open source. But for now, it's just to get them out.
Okay, it's just I'm a get the data out as quick as you can kind of guy, you know, before people come knocking on doors. Anyway,
right.
So there's Ken, and he's got this massive library, and you've been working on that.
Yeah.
What else has kind of come across your desk in terms of uncovering the greater picture? How far do you think you've got the picture, you know? There's Nazis, yes, there's the Fourth Reich, there's the Roman Reich. Can you fill in the blanks between Roman Reich and Aldebaran?
Yes, I can. The Romans are interested in hiding their history, okay? So they're not real interested in sharing anything that's from space or connecting us to from outer space, or that we came here from space or anything like that. They you know, want to keep people grounded on Earth in city states, you know. So their interest is not that, but the occultists who wanted to really know their origins for maybe supremacist type reasons were kind of bucking the church at the time, Hitler and all them. And they wanted to know exactly, you know, they were obsessed with human origins, particularly where the Germanic people came from. And what's funny is they came not too far from Germany in Romania. So they didn't really have to go to Tibet and measure skulls and all that, you know. They didn't have to go to the Canary Islands. That's not right either, you know. They needed to look no further than Hyperborea. So the Hyperborean clues are coming out in the light of day, so to speak, out of the caves, you know. Plato made this incredible allegory, you know, about a cave, you know, and how people perceive the world when they are only shown images and media that is completely controlled, and they become comfortable with that media, and there is no other explanation or source. So it's very painful for people to look at information that's different from what they were ever told, you know. I really don't have to go through the whole entire Plato's cave allegory, but in essence, it was that they had put children in the cave, and they had grown up only seeing puppets and shadow puppets and whatnot. And they had actually given them names and made whole scenarios of characters and everything about these puppets. They were like their family in their life, and they were. One was taken out of the cave and shown the sunlight, and it hurt his eyes. So you get the point of the story, you know. They're only comfortable seeing what they're used, what they've grown accustomed to seeing, and research has been very much dampered because of that issue, that people have a comfort zone about information, and I really don't. I really want to know the truth and all of that. So getting to your question about Aldebaran, the Brill Society was receiving basically signals or advanced automatic writing from literally space people or people from the underground, you know, what they had based some of their folklore on or their mythology on. It was, you know, the book written about the underground city and cities and so forth, and this was the entire book was basically an allegory for these original peoples that came here from space, probably from the moon, to survive, you know, and they had landed and went underground because the surface was not exactly all that inhabitable. There were large beasts running around and so on and so forth. So they had taken solace or sanctuary inside the caves and underground facilities, which some they had actually created. If you look at the town of Cappadocia in Turkey, there is a very strange, large underground city under there, a huge tunnel complex with rooms and everything else that could hold over 20,000 people. So the story is well-founded, you know, as far as them coming here from another planet or something. And the pattern shows throughout history that that's what they do when times get hard, or they have some kind of disaster or apocalypse that's coming from the sky, or some kind of flood situation. They will actually go up higher and build in the tops of the mountains. So in this top of the mountain was, we find in Bashigi anyway, and also in the Himalayas, there's a hollowed cavern system. And there are apparently technologies in there that were recently found by secret societies and military personnel that were holographic in nature, that would actually show a hologram of some of our history. And that was very important to them, to show us our history through whatever modern format they had at the time. Now, I'm looking at these space images, and I'm actually seeing this embedded imagery that seems to appear in the lower frequency images, the ones that were that were half resolution and so forth that were put online and painted out and all of this. And even though they painted them out and all of that, we have to remember that they uploaded them on extraterrestrial technology, which is the digital age we know today with computers and everything else. And these pixels were completely altered, and the patterns are beyond pareidolic. They are very themed, which is against the normal definition of pareidolia, which says that there's no rhyme or reason or theme or anything else. Now, they are highly themed. They are showing in some images, like this one, it's very Disney themed, you know, so there's a lot of Disney material and so forth, Little Mermaid, Mickey Mouse, and all that.
I know. Hang on a second, Brett. I just want to say, Pluto.
Yes, Pluto.
For bloody hell's sake, Pluto, look, has an image. I mean, is that really, or was I looking at a hoax, but
yes,
the image of Pluto really, really does have an image of Pluto the dog on it.
Exactly.
How did he know?
Right. So, yes, I believe that there is some kind of alternate communications, either from very high-up secret societies that have direct influence with extraterrestrial or interdimensional entities, and they are secretly archiving in this manner, you know, with embedded imagery and so on. And you think you're looking at just a black and white picture of the moon, but if you look closer at the image and you go in closer on it, you'll start to see faces and you'll start to see very photorealistic imagery that is embedded in there. And at first I was looking at that and I thought, maybe I'm just a crazy artist, but I see these things, you know. So I started making artwork from them and painting them so other people could see them. And I've got a lot of that imagery in Lars if you go in the photo section on Facebook or something. But there is definitely some kind of encoded, probably extraterrestrial type information in our space images. And this led me on into looking at the Pelagian Empire, because not only can I see these kings and so forth inside this imagery, but I know who they are.
So it's like there are people's character actually expresses itself on the map of the planet. Is that due to their planetary influence, that they so influenced that number of people that the planet actually kind of left an impression of them?
Yes.
Something like that.
And they knew about this. They had imagery from Bohemian Grove, the secret societies there in the Redwood Forest. And in the very old pictures of some of the prominent members of Bohemian Grove, you can see entities all around this man in the forest that are not really clearly theirs per se, but you can see very photorealistic figures of the Green Man and other, you know, different folklores, that little people and all of that. And I said, well, wait a minute, you know, is this in every single image that's ever taken of anything, you know? So I looked at a picture of myself when I was little in Texas, and all around me in this forest are these entities that I can see because I've trained my eye to see behind the veil. And literally photorealistic to me in my perception, which is a very important issue, you know, perception. I can see these creatures that are much different than in the space images. They're more Earth-like and kind of follow along the old Irish folklore of little people and all that, you know.
Brett, could you spell the name of the empire? Pelagi or something?
Pelagian.
Spell it, please.
P P-E-L. Let's see. P-E-L. A-S-I-A-N.
Pelasian.
Yes.
The Empire of Pelasia is a massive, efficient nation ruled by Emperor Sieto.
Hmm.
Right, hang on. This cannot be... This must be a game.
That's yeah. probably a game, yes.
Yeah, it's a game. All right, okay. So, hang on a second.
If people want to read about that, the book by Nikolai Densiziano, please don't ask me to spell that. He wrote a book called Prehistoric Dacia, or Dacia Prehistorica, in Romanian. And it's been translated into English, and it's online somewhere, so you can find it.
What was the name of that guy?
Nikolai Densiziano.
Nikolai. Let's see. I'll put in Nikolai. Haven't got anything yet. Dacian, Moesian and Genome. The Empire of the Huns. Anyway, so yeah, please. Okay, I'm just trying to Google the name of this fellow, but Dacia is spelled D-A-C-I-A.
Yeah, it'll probably come up under the book title, which is Dacia Prehistorica or Prehistoric Dacia.
All right, here we go, Nikolai, Prehistoric Dacia. Here we go. I've got a PDF. There we go.
Yes, excellent.
Okay, I'll publish that. But we've still got... Here's the thing.
Yes.
Lots of people these days, lots of deep researchers, all say, hey, I found Atlantis.
Yeah, they're wrong.
Hang on a second. Because yeah. Some people found it in the Atlantic. Some people have found it in the Mediterranean. You've got it in the Black Sea. Some people say it's in the Antarctica. Okay, so there's a lot of people who have made claims that there's this ancient civilization down there, and they all call it Atlantis.
Right.
There's something that we call Atlantis. There's something that Plato called Atlantis.
Good.
What you're talking about is what Plato called Atlantis. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm going by what Plato said, that Herodotus, who his grandfather or uncle or something who used to talk to about the subject of Atlantis. Herodotus is the one that described Atlantis being the Dacian Empire. And he described it as being beyond the pillars of Hercules and the Planos Sea, which is the Black Sea. And there is hidden meaning in folklore and allegory in Herodotus's story. So I knew that. I knew that it wasn't, you know, literally this fantastic city with all this technology and all of this, you know. Even though there was actually higher technology than what we thought in prehistoric times. Most of the actual artifacts from the real Atlantis, which was Luce Island in the Black Sea, it was the Temple of Apollo, it was the burial ground for Achilles. This place is very important because it is beyond the pillars of Hercules, which is the strait between Tracia and Istanbul. And when you go beyond the pillars of Hercules, you are into the Black Sea. The reason why it's the pillars of Hercules are there because Hercules was the king of Tracia. And you go beyond the pillars, and you find the Danube River Delta, the Danube River Delta. And beyond that is a little island called Luce Island or Snake Island or Alba White Island. It's been given many names, and it's probably part of something else. But the original artifacts from Atlantis, which was basically a city-state around the Danube Delta that empties out into the Black Sea. And that little island was part of that, the remnants of that that city-state. And the artifacts, there was a scuff between the Romanians and the Ukraine, and the Ukraine kind of won out, you know, and they attained the artifacts that were from this island, and they put them into a museum in the Ukraine. In the days of old, you know, when there were ships and sea people and all that, some of those artifacts ended up in Rome, you know, and a lot of people say, well, where did Romans come from? Romania, of course, you know. So there are even older ancient artifacts of Atlantis in the city-state of Rome, and they have put them in plain sight.
Well, would you say that that great big pine cone might be part of that?
Yes.
Tell me what you know about. See, I'm grilling you on not only my own behalf, but these are some of the subjects Nikki and myself have been talking about. So it's quite, you know, it's quite kind of adding in, it's, you know, filling in the background, particularly for me, because she knows sort of more, she's read a bit more about it. But one of the things I do know, or, you know, have heard, or I don't know, I have heard that I know, so some people might know, is that in this place that you've just described, which is, it's the bottom of the Ukraine, and it's just been recently the subject of some invasion with the Russians and everything like that, and that there was a line of 18 pyramids that went down into the water.
Yes.
And one of the things that I believe the planet, there's lots of things that I believe about the planet that kind of run counter to the mainstream, but one of them is that the planet is expanding, and that water from Maldek arrived a while ago and raised our sea level by about 200 feet all over the planet, about 10,000 or so years ago. And this resulted in the filling in of the Mediterranean, what was the Mediterranean Valley, and the filling in of the Black Sea, what was a valley.
Yes, and also flooded flooded right across the area of Mount Ararat into the Caspian Sea.
Exactly. So these are basically splashes, puddles on the face of the earth.
Right.
And, you know, because we're tiny, something to deal with. So
when we're talking about specifically Atlantis and Herodotus's version or Plato's version of Atlantis, they are speaking specifically of their city-state, their people, their ancient ancestors. They're not talking about Cuba or Peru or anything else, even though we know that now today that there were many Atlantis, you know. But the one in particular that they were talking about was from the Black Sea. They ended up being the survivors of the Black Sea and dispersed. Some ended up in Turkey, and then they migrated down, you know, from Mount Ararat or whatever, to Samaria. Now what they have backwards is the timelines. This is what the elites have been playing games with us forever on. These timelines are not correct. The survivors of the Black Sea, of course, is much older than Samaria, which is only 3,000 years old.
Okay, so let's set the timeline straight, because I need to know, too. Number one, the destruction of Maldek. Do you have any intel on that?
Not a whole lot. Maldek is where?
The asteroid belt now.
Oh, okay, good. I don't know about the destruction of a large planet. It seems to be, you know, like a Big Bang type theory, or basically that we got blasted off from a bigger planet called Tiamat. Is that correct?
That's one of the stories. There's lots of stories that I I just collect stories because, you know, there's loads of stories.
According to Madame Blavatsky and what the occultists have attained, you know, through ancient wisdom, ancient writings and folklore and listening to people's stories all through the years, it is that the moon came from the earth.
All right.
And there was a time when the moon was not there. I don't know if that's true. That is another theory, probably maybe misleading theory.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, if the moon came from Earth, that means it was built by the Earth.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
It was built on. It was like a built as a satellite. However, that doesn't. I mean, I see to my eyes and to my consciousness, the moon is a big steel shell. It's a big. It's a planetoid, spheroid, Death Star thing.
If we had special minerals and elements that were exclusive to Earth, then we might scientifically be able to prove that the moon came from the Earth. But that's not the case. The Earth is very similar to Mars. It's very similar to the moon and Venus and everything else. Now, what does make sense to me is the solar cycles provoked migratory patterns. In other words, there was a time when the sun was much cooler, and Venus was also much cooler, and we lived there. And you've heard of the Venusians and so on. These Venusians are the same that come from the little planet near Aldebaran. They are the same people.
Hang on. The little... Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about the environ of the star Aldebaran?
Yeah.
Do you know the name of the planets and the people who live there? Because this is a subject of the communication between the Aldebarans and the Vrills, wasn't it?
Yes.
Do you want to give us a bit of that story? Because I'm still in the dark about that, as it were.
Well, their culture was very much, if you see the movie Jupiter Ascending, their culture was very much like that. It was, if you can imagine that there are Greek gods and goddesses out in space, that is very close to their culture.
Okay, so that's...
We are their descendants.
And that's their spirit is what we call the Nazi spirit.
The Aryan type race, yeah. But you know, I think it's a horrifying thing that they tried to do by making it some kind of supremacist thing, when that's not really true. You know, the race of gods and goddesses and all that out in space are also diverse. That means that there's all kinds of different colors of beings out there, you know. And they came here, and we are all basically descendants from one excursion or another, which I believe that we came in waves onto the Earth. You know, the Earth of course was not inhabitable at one time, and we didn't pop up from the ground. We came from somewhere.
We actually kind of splatted on the ground, really.
Yeah, kind of.
Some of us survived. Yeah. So there are stories, right? That there is a group on Aldebaran that called the Sumi, and this comes from Sean David Morton. That there's another planet where they have their kind of not so perfect people. Where they have their not so perfect people, who are
right.
Essentially the Untermensch.
Compare it with
the Germany thing, and what would happen is that they put them on another planet to deal with them, rather than have them on their planet. They just put them on another planet where they were allowed to do what the heck they liked.
Yeah, sounds very typical.
And that's essentially how they deal with their problems of their world, is they segregate the society. That's their solution. And
yes,
the only
yes.
way they can, because it's not, this is not sustainable, because it's like a Ponzi scheme. You always have to go and find new ground, because, you know, everything will divide into what you like and what you don't like about yourself, because you're expressing it. Now, you know, wherever you go, you'll take you with them. Wherever you go, you'll find the same thing there, because you're taking yourself with you. Yeah.
Absolutely. I do believe that since then, you know, since we came to Earth, we've become a lot more humble because of the survival situation here, and I think we're learning a lot. You know, you can see all through history that they have continued that pattern of segregation and into city states and so forth. If you look around Europe, they're all the same people. These are the same people. Some have different accents and whatnot. It's still from the same people. The accents and all that, and the different languages come from different different levels of the same original language. And you know that basically some are farther along than others with the languages, and that's what makes them different. That's why you see so many similarities in German and English and Danish and all that. So. But these are all the same people. They have migrated into segregated city-states, and Rome is mostly responsible for that, for hiding their history.
Okay, so that's now what we're discovering. So this is now why Rome has a library, Vatican has a library.
Yes.
And so the true headquarters of the deceptive Fourth Reich are... is the Vatican?
Yeah, absolutely, 100% accurate. Yes.
So, let's look back at. Can you see? I had a weird experience a couple of years ago, and I'd like to see if you. I don't think you probably have no idea of what my experience was. So, let's just say that I had a Vatican related experience a couple of years ago. Now, can you tell me anything about something that might be very unusual about what lays below the Vatican? It's on a hill, isn't it?
Yes.
And as we are now becoming aware, wherever there's a hill, the Earth's crust is not very thick. So if there's a hill, underneath there's a hole.
Yeah, it's built right on top of the old catacombs that some of the Gnostics took refuge in, and some of the very early Christians, and so on. And going beyond that, these tunnels and that are connected to different places on Earth, and definitely connected to the tunnel system leading all the way to the pyramids in Romania and the Bishiki Mountains.
The Bosnian Pyramid, they have tunnel that has tunnels to Alexandria and Tibet.
Yes, they've carried out the Chaldean priests and whatnot that were 3,000 years ago in Samaria, carried on this information, and there is actually a segregated society of priests in the Vatican called Chaldean, you know, priests. And these are the guys that brought this information all the way, basically old rituals in that, of the Hispava, Hispathi ritual, that took place, in the tomb of Ramses II. And below the surface, there were catacombs as well, where they had conducted enlightenment rituals. Now, these people, they have... Their true beliefs are not at all what they had created for the masses. Not at all.
Now that's very interesting. We've just passed midnight in the UK. I think, certainly, I know one or two of our listeners do like to have a little bathroom break. during the show. Fascinating, Brett. Fascinating. So let me see if I can find a because I didn't. I've just been, you know. There you go. Anything better than that? No, I'll do that. It's just like heaven, you see. it's been great fun. So here's The Cure with Just Like Heaven.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, yes, The Cure, Just Like Heaven. Because I was just thinking, oh, it's just like heaven. And there it was on my screen, so I thought, oh, there we go, I'll put that on. So, marvelous stuff there, Brett. And so, where shall we take off for this second excursion into the hidden realm? Oh yes, we were down in the catacombs of the Vatican. That's where we were.
Yeah.
And what was going on was that there's tunnels and all sorts of things that are pointing in all directions. Pointing to ancient underground communication systems, which I often wonder, you know, these things are thousands of miles long. It must have taken them bloody ages, or they had some form of transport that could zip down these little tubes.
Absolutely. I guarantee you that those catacombs are the real Vatican Library. And what I'm saying is that the Vatican Library that we know of, where supposedly the artifacts from Alexandria were kept and all of that. They don't really have anything in that library except for some secrets about how they tortured the Knights Templar.
Oh, that's nice. Right.
Well, yeah, so, believe me, there is a real library of ancient artifacts and history.
And that is where?
Part of it was put down there in the catacombs. It's not the only place, though. Rome does not really have the monopoly on all of the ancient history.
No. The Templars have got it somewhere, haven't they?
They sure do.
They have a lot of things.
Yes, they absolutely do. There are factions, you know, with the Knights Templars, and today we know them as Freemasons and whatnot. There are factions. There is good guys and bad guys, just like in any other organization. They call their bad guys the Illuminati, as we do. You know, these Illuminati and whatnot are the ones that still want city-states, and they want to hide our history. Now, the other factions of the Knights Templars are to also hide history, but only to preserve it until its time.
How do they know when it's time? And surely it's got to be right around now.
Well, I have been told by not only black ops organizations, secret space program individuals, lots of different individuals that say that, yes, it is now time to begin disclosure.
I think we're seeing it, because I don't know if you saw the first episode of The X-Files.
Yes. I did, yes, it was great.
They bloody laid it out. They just, there we go. That's everything that we've been, not everything. That's like layer number one.
Right, the only thing that wasn't really true to me in my mind was how does a conspiracy theorist become rich and enough to own a helicopter and everything else, you know?
Exactly.
That was kind of lame, but, you know, the rest of it was great.
Yeah. As always, they're a composite character. You know, there was a bit who's that white haired fellow?
Yes, I like the mysterious informant. Yes.
Yeah. No. But you know, on your TV, in American TV, who's that white haired guy with his opinions?
Oh yes, I know who you're talking.
Short cropped white hair, kind of slightly gay looking. What's his name? I don't know. Anyway, he's got a bit of that about him. Because he's been doing some sort of truth-telling, hasn't he, in the last couple of years?
Yeah, there's
a couple. Man, I can't remember his name.
I can't either. I know. I see the
anyway, he's one of these TV pundits. And a cross between him and Alex Jones, with a bit of Jim Carrey in there. You know, he's a composite, that Ted, Fat Tad.
Yeah, Tad. They're terribly entertaining, but I feel like those people in Plato's Cave sometimes when I'm watching them, because it's irritating to me, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's the opposite of Plato's Cave to me. I see the truth behind the secret and whatnot, you know, very easily. And when they start spouting off about, what we should think and what we should perceive, it's almost like rape.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Mentally. I mean, it is basically doing exactly the same thing on a repeated mild version, but it still pokes at the same it still makes its mark in the way that your soul is violated on, you know, bodily, mentally, or something.
Yes, I don't feel special at all. I will put out the information that I find, you know. Mm-hmm. And because it's a clue for someone else, you know, and that's important to me. The preservation of history is important to me. And when I see them destroy it and devalue it like that, it really is taking away from everyone around the world. It's taking their perception away from them. It's taking their history away, their roots. They have nothing to hold on to. They get depressed. Their frequency is lowered dramatically.
Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck, yeah.
See, I mean, he's like, I mean, and again, going back to, you know, lowering frequency, their fear sells. For some reason, people like to buy the fear. Have you ever figured that one out?
Well, yes.
If I was from another planet, I would not get that.
Well, it's easier to sell fear to people that are scared already, you know. And they're afraid of the unknown. Once religion has got a hold of them and taught them that they should fear death and they should fear all of these things, it was quite easy for these manipulators, you know, to create circumstances to make examples and cause a fear in the public and in the world. And the thing is about that is that it's going nowhere. It's of such low frequency that the Earth doesn't even want it. It expels it, you know. And it will fail. It always does. It already has.
So, well, one of the other things about the Vatican, I was just seeing if I could, see if I could find some more fish. Have you ever heard of the Beast of the Vatican?
Yes. The Black Pope and all that, yeah. Okay.
Well, no, the Beast in the catacombs, down below.
Oh, no, I've not heard of that, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit.
Uh-huh.
You know, probably a reptile.
Worse, it's a sort of I'll briefly outline my experience, right? Basically, I was taken down there, and we were very curious, but not fearful. So we went down and looked, observer mode. It didn't see us, but it was like a huge, it was like Jabba the Hutt. It was like a huge tick, and you know, I kind of saw this thing, and it was like, oh, all right, I see what it is. And I realized that inside of it, it was a kind of mind. It was like a computer. It's like a living computer. And but it was alive, and it consumed energy. And it consumed the energy of, Lush.
Basically. Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was what it kind of was eating, and it was served by these Capensis guys, the guys with the heads, and it brought children to them.
Well, that, you know,
now I don't have very much corroboration of that, but I saw it, And I had a conversation with it.
Like that would not surprise me a bit, and I'm enjoying your human experience, you know, that to a degree, you know. And it, of course, they don't like, you know, hearing that, you know, children are being fed to something or whatever, but you know my background. You know I know that that's true.
Right.
I've seen children being abducted all over the United States, and I was actually one of them when I was a child, you know. And they do consume energy. It is a pattern of the Roman clergy lifestyle. It's for sure. They have always been consumed with youth worship, you know, and that is probably a perversion of their past, you know, because of their youthful gods and goddesses and so on. And they're not having any problem whatsoever of having a house boy or something like that. So it is in the realm of their history, of course, you know. And it's not just the Roman history, but it's also in the Jewish history as well. And it, you know, in their encyclopedias, they describe describe the rules of raping a small girl or something, you know. And what are the rules or something, you know. Religion has been a corruption, of course, you know. It's been a perversion of people's minds, you know. And it has caused an incredible amount of damage to our perception.
And to the population, might I say, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, let's just kill 6 million of them, 20 million of those.
I'm all for spirituality. I'm all for looking for your own perception and looking out into the universe for your own answers. And we don't need a middleman there. You can go directly to the source, you know.
You know, as I've been saying a bit, you know, when you're looking for God, inquire within.
Yeah. Absolutely, yes.
Ah, there's Lyra. There we go. So,
Lyra.
Lyra, yeah, that's right.
Illyria.
So let's talk about Illyria and how it may be a Lyran colony.
Could you? Well, the very word means people from the stars.
Right. Well, that'll do.
These Illyrians were the Albanian. They are a tribe of Albanians that literally kept the oldest language in the world that was able to, any one of them can read the tablets of Thoth. That's how old this language is. And they are the people of the stars. They are the people of Palash, of the man that apparently was in the cave that came with ancient technology and created them, you know, from science, you know. And what I believe happened when, you know, all these stories where it says a spaceman came or Anunnakis came and they created mankind, that to me doesn't feel right. It's more accurate that they came and they took women, you know, of whatever, maybe there was some that they came with. But they populated the planet from a migration from space, and that feels right to my soul, you know, that's correct, that we come from space in one form or another, whether it's within a spirit form that comes from space into the womb where the material is, you know. So that to me feels right because of my human experience, as just, you know, being born on this earth.
It does feel so much easier to feel that, you know, we're quite a mixed bunch and we all come from lots of different places than we all evolved from this one mother who lived in some African village like 400,000 years ago. What BS, you know. So
right, exactly, you know,
and we're all monkeys and we're just, you know, that's just such propaganda.
Yeah, Lloyd Pye did a very good job at proving that we do not come from monkeys.
Yeah. And also that, you know, just because you got a rhesus factor, if you got rhesus negative, doesn't mean you're not a starseed.
That doesn't mean anything at all.
Yeah, it's yeah, indeed, because I'm A positive, so.
So
yeah, that's because I'm from Andromeda, or that. What's the other one? Arcturus.
Arcturus or Pleiades or whatever, you know. But yes, I believe that, you know, the people with light eyes, you know, are definitely a wave of people that came to this earth. No doubt about it. You know, there was no light colored eyes prior to that, prior to Hyperborea.
And what about red hair?
Oh, that's a fascinating thing. I really don't know, but I love carrot cake.
Do you have red hair?
Yes, I do.
Ah, all right. Okay, so here's the thing. There are red-haired Capensis people found all over the planet.
Yeah.
Red-haired giants. Giants are always often depicted as having red hair. Jack and the Beanstalk.
Then there's that you know, entire, you know, ginger day that you guys had. You remember that?
That's insane. There's a TV show called Ideal on the on BBC TV, and in there it's from Manchester, which is like the place where Oasis and all these people come from, and it's there's a gang of ginger people.
Oh, wow.
And it's really creepy to see, like, 9 ginger people all gathered together looking mean.
Well, yeah.
Really quite menacing, let me just say. You know, it's good. You know, have to keep you separated.
Very, very old population, a tribe of Pelagians, you know.
Pelagians, all right. So, we got the Pelagians and the Dacians. So, here's the thing, and I don't know if I asked you this last time, but my theory is that what's his name, Hannibal, didn't get African elephants, but that the elephants were already in the Black Sea area, and he just corralled them over the thing to Rome and really surprised them.
Yeah, that's correct. That you're talking about Hannibal and the the war with him and Alexander the Great.
That's right.
Yes. The war took place actually near India, which would explain a lot.
Uh huh.
So it was you know, of course, Alexander was the king of Babylon at the time, you know, and he was basically outreaching his empire, and wanted to go past the Himalayas, which he apparently successfully did, but he was met with these horrifying elephants and whatnot, and they sadly lost that war, and he was taken back to Babylon and died shortly after that.
But I'm still sort of trying to trace this, trace all the history. So there's another theory, and you know, I know it refers to a TV show, but we know that Stargate contains a lot of truth.
Yes,
and Stargate Atlantis is about a ship that is called Atlantis, that at one point became an underwater base, and then became a floating city, and then at some point also took off into space. Is that right?
Yes. There are points on this Earth that I understand from Andrew Bishago that are actually jump rooms from here to other planets. Uh-huh. And the military found this, of course, and they exploited the energies from the sources and used them to actually travel through time-space, like a fold of time.
Did they happen to find one in Antarctica?
Probably. I wouldn't doubt it. It would, to me, the most powerful stargates on Earth would be on the poles.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's past the magnetic belt.
And they're in the vortex.
Yes, they're in the vortex. So, these particular stargates would seemingly be as though you were traveling through the Earth and then out into space.
Hmm. Well, I suppose it would depend on the direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like
basically in the middle of all planets that rotate, you know, is a very large magnetic engine in the middle. And I believe that our ancient ancestors exploited this energy, as well as our secret space program and everything else.
Hmm. So there's a lot of tunnel systems. There's a lot of underground systems.
Yes, our Earth has a complexity to it. It's hollow in the way that there's catacombs and there's large openings and caverns and all of that all over the surface of Earth, including the Moon. The Moon is the same. It's very porous, mm-hmm. and it's like a sponge, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's titanium all over the Moon, isn't there?
Yes. There's a lot of titanium. What's interesting about the Moon is the strongest material that you have on the Moon is glass.
Glass?
Yes. It doesn't act the same as it does on Earth.
Really?
Yeah, it's more like steel.
So it's transparent and useful?
Yes, absolutely. Nice. You could actually create those domes that Ken Johnston saw in Tsiolkovsky Crater. If you had the technology to do so, which we did not at the time when he saw those, I would imagine that would be the most useful material you could use to create an environment or a dome.
That certainly would be. How? All right. So, how come the properties of glass are different on the Moon than they are on Earth? What is different? Is it?
Yes,
proximity to the central gravitational thing of the Earth that creates glass to be hard and brittle? What's that?
Yes.
What's it all about?
Yes, it very much has to do with the brittleness of the glass and gravity. On Earth, it also has to do, of course, when you're talking about glass, you're talking about frequency. So it's much denser in a way on the Moon, and it's also a lot more flexible, so it's not as brittle. So it does crack, I would imagine, if a big asteroid hit it or something like that, but it won't break.
So it's more of a liquid crystal there, and that may be because of frequency.
Yes, absolutely. Frequency is a very interesting thing, because the higher the frequency, the more creation happens. You know, on Earth, of course, when you're talking about like something extreme like a diamond or something, it takes an incredible amount of high frequency energy to create a diamond. And other things, you know, even your desktop computer takes a lot of high frequency energy to create anything within our 3D realm. And what the elites and all of them have been trying to do is lower the frequency so much that it depletes our creation, you know, our creative ability to advance, to go anywhere. So it's very much on purpose as far as the esoteric circles go.
All right. So that's the way it is so far.
Yeah.
Let's work on how do we make a change? How can someone make a change tonight? How can someone make a change this week?
How someone can make a change tonight is ask the universe to improve their perception of what is true in the universe, in universal law, and to actually send out vibrations and energy to the world and to the universe and not themselves. They will benefit from it, you know. But it is very important, if they want results, to be of service to the universe and to everyone else. And that probably goes against capitalism and everything that my country believes in as a whole, you know. But I truly, personally believe that. I think raising the frequency, raising energy, and there's no right or wrong way to do it. You could sit on the toilet and do this, you know. There's no right or wrong way. As long as it's really genuine, and just as though you were trained to talk to God in religions or something, do the same for the universe.
Yep, you don't have to personify
the
spirit of the universe. It's because it's everywhere. It doesn't have a face.
It doesn't have a name or a face or anything like that. That's ridiculous.
Personification. There you go.
I'm kind of way beyond, you know, trying to prove whether or not religion is telling the truth or this or that. I'm way beyond that. I could care less about that. I'm truly fascinated and interested in our personal energy that we could actually put out there and give back to this earth, because we're destroying it with this low frequency stuff. So if people want to, and I would also like to say that if people are thinking about depression or suicide or something like that, we are alive. We are very high energy beings. We were created by high frequency energy, and we're just simply alive. That's not going to change if we don't have a body. So it's absolutely ridiculous to have those thoughts. Raise your thought patterns, you know, and basically come out of Plato's cave and experience the world for yourself, because we're here to have a human experience, and that's all we're responsible to do.
Very good. I mean, one of the title I gave to this show was, what did I call it? The Mantle of Disclosure.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, our last show was unpeeling truth's protective layers. So
yeah,
I think between the last time we spoke and now, so many of those truth's protective layers have been peeled back.
Oh my gosh.
Since we had that conversation, and it wasn't that long ago, it was like some, you know, it was just a few months ago, but it was like, it really was the time when the whole thing was starting to pick up, and now there it is in the mainstream, you know, and we're seeing things that, you know, we're basically being vindicated after many years of a deliberate ridicule. So it's like there's a policy change by the people that are or that were.
Oh yeah. Yes. If anyone's interested in how I started out in this story, me and Karen Christine Patrick had written a book on tinyurl.com/spaceartebook. And it pretty much describes my story of how I got interested in this when I was 15
years old. Can you spell that out?
Yes. tinyurl.com/spaceart ebook. And that is a free ebook that anyone can read about my story so far. I'm writing a book called Digital Moon, which will go into a lot more detail about what we were talking about Ken, meeting Ken Johnston and all of that. He's given me a very happy ending to that book.
Oh, excellent.
I have a lot of respect for Dr. Johnston.
Excellent. And yes, so on your website, which is, you've got a Digital Moon website, haven't you?
Yes, I have a Digital Moon website. That's eventually where that book will sit. And I've been working on Ken Johnston's archive and getting his autobiography out, so I kind of set that aside for a little bit. And it's worth it because he's giving me an ending to that book. So it's, please hold your horses. That is going to be an excellent book.
There's a very interesting cross-fertilization that's going on at the moment, you know, because there, what's you know, in days gone by, writers didn't get much chance to talk to each other and share their research. And now people are doing some research, publishing it, and the next day on Facebook somebody's replying saying, well, look at this, I've got some other pieces of your puzzle.
Absolutely. And that's what we... That is so important, that everyone, even though they think that they have nothing, there is a subtle piece that they carry on this timeline that is so important. It's more important than themselves. It's important to get this information out, and if they have any information whatsoever that they have been harboring because someone threatened them or whatever, get it out anyway, because they can't do anything to you if you have all of the information out. And even if they do, it's important, it is the most important thing that we're here for, is to transmit our history to the future.
That's right. I'm, you know, and what I'm doing, I'm just putting it out. I'm putting it out and just, like, keeping going.
Yeah, me too.
Live and direct.
That's what I've been told by extraterrestrial entities, is to just to keep going.
Yep. That's the thing. I do believe that whatever you know, whatever huge computer system, the NSA stroke military industrial stroke, you know, trafficking awful demon system has, whatever computer big thing that they've got, the energy that comes out of the truth that is bursting out of our Wolf Spirit archives, whenever they take a copy, which they probably take every couple of weeks, when it'd be handy if we had a link to the backup just in case, but you know, but somewhere it's sitting there and those digits are kind of hanging out together and maybe spreading the word to other digits, and because it's all crystal and it knows what's going on.
Oh, absolutely.
And it doesn't like it, apparently. And who would? The crystal being itself, the silicon being, doesn't like this stuff. Doesn't like it being itself being used like that.
No, absolutely not. The Earth has an energy, and I don't know whether that's a physical manifested being or what that is, but the Earth is a very sensitive being, you know, in spirit anyway, and does not like to be used as energy to propel us out into space and all of the, it's so disrespectful and ungrateful for what we have here, this creation that has been developed, that is like to other planets like a heaven. It is a potential heaven, and we are taking some of the jealous spirits and stuff from the universe that maybe inhabitants of planets that aren't such good ETs, that don't want to see us succeed, you know, as a species on this planet. And but there are also very good entities out there, and they are just like us. There's good and bad in their societies, you know, and they want to see us very much succeed, so that we can become a bigger part of the universe, even though we already are. Yeah.
So, solutions in daily life.
Yes.
Attitudes to take.
Yes, understand the system and what it's done to people, and it's basically like seeing the emperor in its underwear.
Basically, yeah.
You know, it is what it is right now, And we should use our human compassion and understanding to help those people along for whatever their problems are, you know. We don't have to get involved with drug addicts and all these people that that are so steeped in low energy that we can't, you know, we can't do anything for them. They have to help themselves, you know. But there are a lot of people out there that we can connect with that understand how to solve some of these issues in the world, you know, through higher frequencies. And you know, a lot of the New Agers have gone on a tangent about this, but some of them have broken off into some type of death cult where they, you know, they think they're going to get a new Earth and go into the fifth dimension and all this stuff, which I think is a crock of crap, to be honest. You know, if we're going to have a new Earth, it's going to be because of us right here on this Earth.
Well, that's the thing. There seems to be a meme about, you know, let's get off the planet.
Yes.
There also seems to be an agenda of let's get humans off this planet. There's also another agenda, let's get lunch. Let's get lunch delivered, which I don't like the idea of, because that's the other side of getting on the ships. And the other idea is to manifest the buggers out of here. Everything, every last one of them.
They'll leave, because the lower frequencies like lower frequencies, you know. So they don't want to hang around us higher frequency individuals that are about creation. All these artists and all of these musicians and all of these people that are putting out tones and poetry and everything. They want to leave. They want to leave and get away from that, because it is their Plato's cave. They are uncomfortable to deal with such creativity. They don't understand it. They're not creative beings. So they get into their secret space program ships, and they hover over the Earth, you know. And I don't know what they're waiting for, but they can learn from us as well. They can change. They can come back to Earth and be honest.
Isn't there some story that they're fed? That, you know, the Earth has been destroyed in this terrible Holocaust, and there's no point going back there, and don't even think about it. Yeah, actually, that's in the folklore of Deep Space Nine, isn't it?
More or less. Yeah.
So, do you know anything about this kind of apparent myth that goes around the people on the other side of that secret space program veil?
Yes, it's very interesting. They don't live in the so-called same frequency that we're in, you know. So they have their own history, which is our history. It's our true history that they've tried to keep from us. But the difference is they've perverted their history, so that it isn't really, in essence, exactly correct, you know, from the perspective of honest history. They live in a totally different secluded, gated type space community, you know, and it's somewhat of an Elysium type thing that they're living in. And I'm not sure if they've made it to the moon or not. I don't think they want them there. And this is the problem, is that they are kind of a derelict ship, which, you know, we've known about an ancient derelict ship that supposedly crashed on the moon, and an entity was taken out, which is, there's probably truth in that. The videos that you see on YouTube and all that are fake, but there probably is some truth to that there are derelict people that try to escape the Earth for political reasons or out of fear of society. That they had utilized and bent society so much that they are afraid of their own people, and they'll leave in these derelict ships, and for what? To go where? You know, to Mars? because, you know, it's like we've already been to Mars. We've already left Mars because it was horrible, and we came to Earth. These solar cycles are very, very long periods of time. And when the sun cools, it makes another planet more accessible to live on, such as Venus or something. And Venus would stay Earth-like for a very, very long time, for generations and generations. And right now, what is happening to the Earth is getting hotter, and they're not telling people about it.
Which is what they call global warming, right?
Yeah, which is global warming on steroids, you know? It has everything to do with the sun. And
nothing to do with RVs.
Nothing to do with the environment or spraying stuff in the air or anything else. It has to do with the sun is getting so hot that it's breaking through the magnetic barrier that Earth has. And in essence, it'll take quite a long time for it to get too hot. So yes, in a sense, we're frogs that don't know we're boiling or whatever. But this is over so many centuries from now, even, that we would have to actually think about survival and leaving the Earth. These secret space programs are already thinking of those things, that we need to. It's already too uncomfortable for them because of the high frequency.
So, I mean, this is one of the things that I've been considering, is that, say perhaps these galactic waves that are coming in bring us to such a point when we are able to telepathically communicate with anyone, anywhere, who is human. And it turns out that, like, we are, like, 1%, you know, the whole planet, our 7 billion people, 1% of the whole human race, you know. What do we do? What do you think? I mean, what do you think you would be, well, personally, how would you feel about that experience?
Right, whether we practice it or not, there is, Rupert Sheldrake is correct that there is a morphogenic field where the human spirit communicates through. That's where we get all of our ideas from the universe from. And in that way, we telepathically communicate all of these ideas. It's kind of like Hollywood comes out with a movie or such, and there's some guy in Arkansas or somewhere, you know, saying, well, I had that idea a week ago, and then now they're coming out with it. It's my idea. Well, it's not actually his idea. It's many people's idea.
Yeah, as I say, thoughts are things that have people.
Yeah. And there is a lot of synchronicity going on when you can actually feel that telepathic communication happening. There's a lot of synchronicities.
Yeah.
And yes, as simple as just interpersonal, you meet somebody and you know that they're bad. Or you feel that they're a good guy.
Or there's this other one, which I see sometimes, is you see, you're in a group of people, and you see somebody on the other side of the room, and it's like everybody else is two-dimensional and they're three-dimensional.
Oh my gosh, yes, they're glowing they're glowing.
And they're it's very clear and sharp, high definition, everybody's kind of slightly low resolution, you know what I mean?
Yes, and that's what the frequency is that I'm talking about. You can feel that.
So these are other people who are vibrating at a frequency that is congenial. That is congenial to you.
Yes, it's very palpable, yeah. And it's, we are all descendants from very unique races of individuals out in space, you know. In the ancient times used to call them gods and goddesses, you know. We are basically the descendant of that. We're not lesser than that. We are not. But we don't know it because we have been put down so hard. And we have been segregated so much that even our own families are completely spread out and separated. We have been that segregated. And the power is with us getting together. It's the power of us knowing that that we are one big tribe, you know, in one frequency. That's very powerful.
It is indeed. So it's really interesting, you know, you talk about, you know, proving morphic field and stuff like that. We don't simply believe in the morphic field. We use it here on the show. In 15 minutes' time, Frank will be using the morphic field of the audience and the listeners to perform remote healings.
Yes, that's exactly right. Rupert Sheldrake says, you know, even though he can't prove his theory, was incredible. The theory, it's more than a theory, you know. It is an explanation of those things that we can't see, you know, that are actually happening. Like I was saying before, he did an experiment on the BBC where he showed these puzzle pictures, you know, these images that are very similar to the moon pictures I'm looking at. And a lot of people in the UK got, you know, they got the image right. You know, it's a cowboy, literally. But it looks like, you know, cow, you know, little cow patches on the image, like black and white. But if you look at it with a certain perception, you see a cowboy. Well, many people in the UK got that right. And he showed the images to Germany and Europe, and they got it. They seem to have gotten it quicker. And then he showed it to America, and it took them a very long time. But, you know, they're not used to looking at puzzle pictures or something. They're living in Plato's cave. But the point was is that because he had already put it out in the morphogenic field, Europe got it right away. And they did not see the program. It was closed, you know, closed circuit.
Yeah, that's right. It was on Anglia TV or something. It was really a very small area.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Anglia TV.
That's cool.
Hey, do you remember the Vrillon transmission?
Yes, I do. Wasn't that neat?
I did a cover version of that. Because I thought, let me see what I can do with 1970s technology. And in the 1970s, available to universities was the world-famous Akai 4000 DS, three-head multi-track tape recorder, or, you know, three-head two-track. It was a two-track tape recorder. You know, it would do stereo, basically. It was the first sort of thing. And marvelous thing with these great big levers that you have to turn, like, to switch the thing on. You know, no, it was a really mechanical thing, but fantastic machine. Anyway, so with one of those, I thought, I bet if I set up my digital system here to impersonate that, I could make it sound like that. And lo and behold, guess, yeah, you could reduce the speed. So what I did, I took the original one. And it was all this, your whole, and I pitch shifted it so that it sounded normal, and guess, lo and behold, it sounds just like a kind of university professor, you know, or some kind of academic type, a sort of dry academic voice, just kind of making some new age BS up. It's brilliant. It was a prank.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. But yeah, that transmission was very unique. Absolutely.
It's on my SoundCloud page, on my Everbeyond SoundCloud. I'll post the thing in the chat room if anybody's absolutely interested.
If you really have to wonder if you can recreate it, then, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt.
I know. See when I was younger, you know, I read George Adamski, and I read all this, and I saw Behind the Iron Curtain, Secrets from Behind the Iron Curtain, you know, psychic research and things like that. And I saw all these things, and, you know, I believed in aliens and extraterrestrials, and then I grew up, and, you know, there was the X-Files, and, you know, still, I used to glue myself to sci-fi, and I was never interested in the news. And now I realize that I was absolutely spot on, and that there's more truth in the sci-fi shows that I was glued to than the TV news that was horrifying me. And I think I was pretty right about that.
Yeah, that's excellent. You came out of Plato's cave, and yeah, exactly.
So
the mainstream media is there's nothing to that information. There really isn't.
Yeah. Where is it? Oh, I can't find it now. I've got another account. Anyway, so, Brett, do you want to give everybody website information, how they can get hold of you, how they can interview you and grill you for more amazing nuggets?
Yeah,
fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll give my email, brettcollin@gmail.com. BRETCOLIN, all lowercase, @gmail.com. And you can also go to Facebook and join the Lunar Anomaly Research Society, or LARS. And you can also contact me on Facebook on, it's Brett C. Shepherd, S-H-E-P-P-A-R-D, on Facebook. And I think I used my actual middle name, Collin. Try both ways, you know, C-O-L-I-N. Anyway, I really enjoy talking to you. It's so much fun, you know. I like it.
Thanks so much. It is great fun, Brett. And so, look, let's hook up again, and we'll peel off some more layers and see where it takes us.
That sounds great. And I'll talk to Ken to see if he wants to come on your show, too.
I would love to get Karen involved.
Karen and also Ken.
Dr. Ken, indeed. Indeed.
I think he would really enjoy your show. And he's trying to get his story out, you know. He talked to Spain a little while ago, and he was on J.B. Wells and Kerry Cassidy, and I'm sure he would really
like it. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, similar genre. JB, he's the man with the microphone.
Oh, my gosh, doesn't he have a cool voice?
He's got the voice through the microphone and the microphone. Anyway, so, Brett, Collin Shepherd, thank you so much for attending with me this afternoon at the Alternative Sunday Service on Ever Beyond. It's been a pleasure.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Good night, everybody. Beyond.